Imagine waking up one morning, going to work, and suddenly realizing your absolute closest coworker just, well, never actually existed.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is terrifying.
Right. And the only reason you even have a vague sort of glitchy memory of them is because you and your friends, like, believed in them so hard that the universe retroactively wrote them into history.
I mean, it completely shatters our basic assumptions about how reality even works.
Yeah.
We expect history to be a fixed foundation.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You drop an apple, gravity pulls it down.
Yeah.
An event happens, the ink dries, and it's permanent.
Yeah, it's supposed to be this immutable timeline. But today we are throwing that entire concept completely out the window. So welcome to this deep dive into the source material. We have an incredible stack of sources today.
We really do.
Yeah, we're talking fantasy chronicles, deep lore wikis, and these extensive author notes that detail a meticulously crafted universe called Mirari.
It's quite a lot to get through.
It is. And our mission for you today is to unpack this dense, action-packed narrative and figure out how a seemingly standard magical realm operates on a, frankly, terrifyingly fragile metafictional architecture. We are going to look at how collective belief literally overwrites history.
It's a brilliant setup, honestly, because it cloaks these really high-level ontological concepts like questions about the very nature of being and reality inside a fun high fantasy adventure.
Totally. To give you a quick lay of the land, this world of Mirari is currently in absolute chaos.
Right. Things are not going well.
No, not at all. A dark lord known as the Destroyer, who is also called Lord Eon, has impersonated a nobleman named Lord April. He's usurped power, and he's basically fractured the entire kingdom.
Yeah, and now this ragtag group of heroes from both the magical realm and the mortal world are just desperately trying to stop him.
Okay, let's unpack this, because we need to start with how you actually fight a war in a world that operates on dream logic.
Yeah, that's a huge hurdle right off the bat.
It really is. The story drops us right into two parallel rescue missions, and the contrast between how they handle conflict tells us everything we need to know about how this universe functions.
It's a perfect entry point, I think, because before we can get to this sort of philosophical architecture of the universe, we have to look at the immediate mechanics of survival.
Right, the boots on the ground.
Exactly. You have these two groups racing against time, utilizing completely different methods of interacting with this world.
So let's look at the first group. We have a little blonde girl named Alice,
who sometimes goes by Angel or Jill, depending on the source.
Right. And she is standing in this beautiful fairy tale glade. She's standing over this alabaster stone slab where a giant bear knight named Sir Theodore is completely dormant. He's just fast asleep.
And the Destroyer's forces are gathering, so she urgently needs to wake this ancient army.
But she doesn't, like, cast a fireball or recite some archaic magic spell.
No, and this is where the mechanics of Mirari's magic really begin to show their true colors. She pulls out a massive snowy white leather Bible from under the sleeping bear's paws.
Which is just such a surreal image.
It is. And she finds a bookmark leading to the 37th chapter of Ezekiel. The text itself is literally shimmering in blue ink on the page.
I love this part. She stands on her tiptoes, projects her voice exactly the way her music teacher taught her, and she just reads the prophecy out loud.
Yep, just reads it.
And as she reads, a breeze picks up, tiny blue stars fall like glitter, and this massive bear knight just sits up with a clink of armor. Just like that, an entire slumbering cavalry awakens.
What's really fascinating here is the specific choice of text and how it functions as a literal command prompt.
A command prompt, like encoding.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 37th chapter of Ezekiel is the Valley of Dry Bones. It's a very famous prophecy about breathing life back into the dead. In Mirari, a mortal reading a resonant, deeply believed text from the real world doesn't just invoke a pretty metaphor. It executes a command. Alice is essentially inputting a line of code directly into the environment.
That is a wild way to look at it, but it makes perfect sense, especially when you contrast it with the second group of heroes.
Oh boy, the second group.
Yeah, they are trying to solve their problem using brute force, and it is going terribly for them. They are traveling in a flying black yacht made of dense wood.
Which is just an inherently absurd military vehicle.
Completely absurd. And this bizarre vehicle is piloted by a homesick djinn named Nashida Al-Zephyr, who is just desperate to get back to her island in the Great Sea.
Right. She does not want to be there.
Not at all. And aboard the yacht are heroes like Thomas, the Lord Explorer, a formidable knight named Agatha, who goes by Redmayne, and a magical white stallion named Ahern.
It's a luxury craft that they've basically repurposed for a war zone.
Exactly. And we see exactly how clunky it is when these two storylines converge. The yacht is cruising over a location called the Greensward, and the crew spots their friends down below.
That's Hannah and a deer-like Forruv named Caradoc.
Right. Yes. And they are being absolutely swarmed by the destroyer's troll army. So the crew decides, okay, we need to intervene from the air.
Which sounds like a good idea until you remember what they're flying.
Right. Nishita, the djinn, points out the glaring flaw in this plan. She basically yells at them that she can crash the boat into the trolls, sure, but it's a boat, not a sword.
So they attempt this incredibly clumsy aerial rescue. I mean, they are trying to hover this massive wooden structure low enough for Hannah and Caradoc to jump aboard.
Or drop ropes to airlift them out or something.
Yeah, all while angry trolls are swarming the landing zone.
I couldn't stop laughing reading this part because it perfectly, and I mean perfectly, mirrors those terrible video game escort missions.
Oh my gosh, yes.
You know the ones. You are forced to pilot a massive, slow-moving transport vehicle to save a completely helpless character, and the game mechanics just do not support it. You're bumping into trees, the enemies are too fast, and it's a total disaster.
It's so frustrating.
But then, right when the trolls are closing in, a perfectly timed, overpowered cutscene triggers. Sir Theodore's newly awakened cavalry just appears out of nowhere.
Right, the bear cavalry arrives.
Yeah, a little girl leading a bear cavalry completely routs the trolls instantly. The yacht doesn't even have to engage.
It highlights a crucial difference in how to navigate complex systems, honestly. I mean, we constantly try to brute force solutions in our own lives. We try to swat flies with a flying yacht, so to speak.
It's a great way to put it.
We use heavy, clumsy tools because they are what we have on hand. But the most elegant, effective solution often comes from an entirely disconnected parallel effort. Alice's quiet, localized interaction with the underlying code of the world achieved what a massive aerial assault just could not do.
Okay, I see where you're going with the system code analogy, and it perfectly sets up what happens next. Because the physical battle with the trolls is won, right? But once the heroes are reunited on the deck of the Black Boat, they are immediately hit with an invisible structural crisis.
Yeah, a much bigger problem.
But before we get to the really terrifying part of that, I want to talk about how Alice heals their leader, Lord Melchizedek. He is this giant black unicorn with a fiery mane, but he's been petrified. He's turned into dark gray stone.
Which is another physical problem that requires a totally non-physical solution.
Right. Because Alice doesn't chip away at the stone. She steps up to him, counts out positions like a clock face on the deck, and walks widdershins, which means counterclockwise, three times around the statue.
And then the rhyme.
Yeah, she recites a rhyme, gets hoisted up, touches the horn of her stuffed unicorn toy to the stone statue's horn and just says, bop.
Bop.
And the petrification shatters, just like that.
It seems like simple childlike whimsy, right?
Huh.
But if we keep looking at Mirari as a coded system, Alice is applying an administrative override.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, in a universe governed by belief and imagination, a child's absolute certainty, symbolized by that stuffed toy and the counterclockwise motion, it carries more weight than the magic that turned the unicorn to stone in the first place.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because that same power of belief that can heal a stone unicorn can also completely break the universe.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
Definitely. During their impromptu council meeting on the deck of this boat, Alice reveals a massive complication. There are two versions of a guy named Simon.
The Simon paradox. Yeah. This is really the turning point of the entire narrative.
Yes. She explains that there is the real Page Simon, a boy from the mortal world, who is currently captured by the destroyer. But then there is a knight among their own ranks named Sir Lefelon, who looks exactly like Simon.
Identical.
And when Thomas and Redmayne hear this, the realization hits them like a freight train. They deduce that Sir Lefelon was never originally a noble knight.
No, they realize he was a changeling, a kobold sent by the destroyer to infiltrate the hero's ranks, taking the form of the boy Simon.
But wait, hold on. If he was just a spy in disguise, why is this a paradox? I mean, spies use disguises all the time.
Because of how the heroes reacted to him. Thomas, Redmayne, and the others, they didn't know he was a changeling. They truly, deeply believed he was a noble, heroic knight named Sir Lefelon.
Right.
And in Mirari, collective, unshakable belief from powerful figures doesn't just change a person's reputation, it actually rewrites their fundamental reality.
They hacked the universe.
Yeah.
Just by believing in him.
Precisely. The hero's collective belief caused what the sources call a ripple in the timeline. The changeling's original existence, its past, its motives, its true form was completely erased. The universe literally buckled under the weight of their belief and retroactively wrote a new history to accommodate this noble knight.
I really struggled to comprehend this when I was reading the source material. It is exactly like overwriting a save file in a video game. Yeah, you click save and the previous data is just gone.
Erased.
But we aren't talking about digital code here. We are talking about a living timeline. The ontological terror of this is staggering. The changeling wasn't killed, it was unhappened.
And we see the structural damage this causes to the timeline through Lord April. Lord April suddenly develops a blind spot in his memory. He cannot remember his former Tree Man spy, a creature named Tier 2.
Yes. And the logic behind this blind spot is fascinating. The changeling must have replaced Tier 2 in the original unaltered timeline.
Right.
But when the heroes retroactively erased the changeling to make Sir Lefelon real, the universe had to stitch the gap closed. If the changeling never existed to replace Tier 2, then the events surrounding Tier 2 became a paradox.
So the timeline just scrambled.
Yeah, Tier 2 was edited out of existence entirely just to make the new reality mathematically fit. It's a terrifying glitch.
This raises an important question. Why is the reality of Mirari so easily hacked in the first place? I mean, a universe where a simple misunderstanding can delete a person's existence and scramble the memories of a lord is a universe with zero structural integrity.
Which brings us to the core mythology of Mirari. We finally get an explanation from Thomas and the Unicorn as to why this world is so incredibly fragile. They drop some massive lore on the group.
It's a huge revelation.
Mirari is deeply, intrinsically tied to the mortal world, a place they call Anakten. But Mirari wasn't always a structured fantasy kingdom with castles and knights. Decades ago, it was a place called the Wild.
And the Wild is described by Lord Melchizedek as a realm of pure, unadulterated nightmare logic. It was a chaotic dreamscape where nothing remained static from one second to the next.
No rules at all.
None. You could be walking down a path, and a person next to you might randomly turn into a horse. The ground beneath your feet could just dissolve into a swamp. Space and time themselves could collapse into nothingness. It was highly malleable, raw, creative energy without any boundaries.
So to fix this nightmare, the first king of Mirari, a man named Riordan, who was actually a mortal from Anakten named Ryan Jordan, teamed up with Lord Melchizedek.
Right, they needed a solution.
They realized they needed to build a container for this chaos, and they used the imaginations of mortal children, specifically a family called the Harcourts, to solidify the realm. They basically applied a mortal patch to the universe.
The OS analogy really holds up perfectly here. The Wild was raw, compiling code that kept crashing. Riordan and the Harcourts wrote an operating system over it.
They coded the rules.
Exactly. They instituted strict rules to stabilize the realm. For example, they created the rule of a year for kings to establish temporal boundaries. They traded infinite, chaotic possibility for a stable, navigable reality.
But the patch isn't flawless. Because mortal children wrote the original code, mortals from Anakten like Thomas, Redmayne, Alice, and this missing boy Simon still carry the administrative privileges to alter those rules.
They can push updates to the system.
Which perfectly explains why Alice can use a stuffed animal to bypass petrification magic, or why the hero's belief could trigger a ripple that overwrote the changeling.
They have root access to the world's underlying architecture. And honestly, this revelation entirely reframes the conflict with the Destroyer.
Right, because the Destroyer, Lord Eon, isn't just a generic Dark Lord. He is John Harcourt. He is one of those original mortal coders.
You have built it.
He understands exactly how the mortal patch works. And now that he has the real Page Simon, who currently possesses that mortal power to alter the rules, his goal isn't just to usurp the throne and, like, tax the peasants.
No, he doesn't want to rule the system. He views the system as a mistake.
Exactly. He is the personification of that original chaos. But he doesn't just want to revert Mirari back to the Wild. He wants to reduce it to the void. Absolute nothingness.
He wants to initiate a complete system wipe. A factory reset to zero.
So what does this all mean? The stakes for the narrative just went from a regional conflict to a literal battle for existence. This isn't a fight over territory anymore.
It is an ontological war. Standard political conflicts are about who gets to sit in the chair and make the laws. The Destroyer wants to delete the room, the chair, the concept of laws, and the memory that any of it ever existed.
It's chilling.
And the heroes are suddenly realizing that swinging swords at trolls is completely inadequate. They cannot just defeat John Harcourt physically.
Right, that won't work.
They have to figure out how to write a permanent patch to save the architecture of reality itself. They must lock down the source code before he can unravel it.
It's an incredibly heavy burden. And once the heroes understand these literal universe-ending stakes, they have to decide their immediate tactical next steps right there on the deck of the yacht.
No time to process.
None. They're forced to make rapid, high-stakes decisions, and it requires a brutal division of resources. They agree to take the spooky black boat to the Palace of All Seasons to try and rally the lords of the realm.
But there's a problem with that. Flying a giant, ominous black yacht toward a highly paranoid palace guard is a pretty great way to get shot down by friendly fire.
Yeah, that would be bad. So they need an advance party. Redmayne and the magical horse Ahern are tasked with riding ahead at breakneck speed. They need to deliver a warning letter to the guards, and to prove its authenticity, they seal it with Alice's unicorn signet ring.
Meanwhile, Thomas is going completely off-grid.
Yes.
He knows that Simon vanished in a puff of smoke back at the palace, so Thomas plans to track Simon's scent from that specific magical residue to find exactly where the destroyer is hiding him.
It's a very tactical, hyper-focused plan, but amidst all this massive universe-saving strategy, there is this incredibly quiet, poignant moment between Alice and Redmayne.
It's arguably the emotional core of this entire sequence.
It really is. Alice is sitting there, packing her healer supplies, separating her various poultices and bandages, and she confesses something deeply personal to Redmayne.
Yeah.
She realizes that if Thomas and the others actually succeed, like, if they manage to fix the rules and permanently stabilize Mirari's code, it might sever the connection to her mortal home in Ainnington forever. The bridge between the worlds might close.
And Alice, this little girl, says that she wants to stay.
Which is wild.
It's a profound choice. She understands that a broken, fragile, magical world needs a healer far more than her safe, stable mortal home does. She is choosing her duty to a vulnerable system over the comfort of her own origins.
And think about how that applies to us, though. When you are faced with massive systemic problems, whether it's a chaotic dynamic at work or a fractured community, our instinct is usually to retreat to what is safe and stable.
Definitely.
It requires a tremendous amount of courage to look at a fundamentally broken environment and say, this is where I am needed most, so this is where I will anchor myself. Alice is willing to give up her entire past to ensure that Mirari has a future.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that sacrifice is what elevates this from a clever fantasy story to a real meditation on responsibility. The heroes are no longer just reacting to a villain. They are taking ownership of the reality they inhabit, flaws, glitches, and all. They are committing to maintaining the system.
It really is an incredible journey. I mean, we started this deep dive looking at a fairy tale glade where a shimmering blue Bible revived a slumbering bear knight.
Which feels like a lifetime ago.
It does. We watched a clumsy flying yacht try to execute a doomed rescue mission, only to be saved by a parallel elegant solution. We grappled with the terrifying realization that collective belief could overwrite a changeling's timeline and scramble the memories of an entire world.
And we finally uncovered that this entire universe is just a fragile, mortal patch covering a nightmare void currently under threat of a total system wipe.
Exactly.
The heroes of Mirari discovered that their stable world was shaped entirely by the beliefs and imaginations of outsiders, and that the rigid rules they took for granted were actually highly malleable. So, I'll leave you with this final thought.
Let's hear it.
Look around at the rules, systems, and institutions in your own life. The corporate structures you work within, the societal norms you follow, the narratives you just accept as absolute immutable truth. What if they're just as malleable? If collective belief can override a timeline and erase a changeling in Mirari, what reality are you accidentally keeping alive just by believing in it? And more importantly, what could you change if you chose to believe in something else?
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We'll see you next time as we continue to unpack the stories and systems that shape our world. Keep questioning the rules and keep exploring.